Okay, I'll start all over.
You'll have to start all over on this because...
Olson had come down with a mandate that did include development of the program in engineering. And he was not doing anything about it. And he came under pressure.
Well, they admitted students, but didn't get any faculty.
But they didn't have any faculty.
Right.
And so John Lee came in as a candidate for the position of Dean of Engineering. And Olson gave the Albanians a very glowing account of him, and they turned this around on Olson and said, if he's that good, maybe we should make him president. And that's what happened. He came in as president. And so that the emergence of John Lee on the scene in the first place came out of this tension over whether the college should have an engineering component or not, which the people in favor of a small liberal arts college didn't want all along. And Olson clearly did not want.
No, but I think this was a slap in the face to Olson.
Absolutely.
Because I think on two grounds, philosophically or ideologically, and then he expected to be president. I think he was disappointed.
Yes.
That they turned around and suggested Lee to come in as president. And
who appointed Olson, and from where did he come?
Olson came from Chicago. He was an assistant to
Carlson. He came in, wasn't it Carlson that sent him?
He worked with Carlson.
He was assistant to Carlson. And the decision was
in Albany?
In Albany.
Yeah.
And the decision was made in Albany, trustees' decision, I guess, to develop a small teachers' college on Long Island. Carlson sent him down to start it up.
Originally it was just science and mathematics teaching, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
it was Sputnik that added engineering.
That's right. Oh, Sputnik and the engineering, right.
And that's right. 57.
58.
Sputnik was 57.
57.
Okay.
And by 58, it was already clear, because I came out there for an interview, that Olson was telling me that even though on paper it spoke of science, math, for example, engineering, it was also going to include a wider variety of work in the humanities and social sciences.
And when did you come?
58.
You came in 58.
Yeah.
Sydney and I are members of the same class.
Yeah, we both came 58.
Rapid change in...
1 year. The first year was 57.
The nature of the mandate, the conceptions.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But you know, when I came in 58, I didn't come for a small teacher's college in science and math. I mean, it was my understanding when I came that we were going...
Who appointed you?
Leonard Olson.
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
But I didn't come... When I came in to build a major chemistry department, I didn't come with any other thoughts in mind.
Olson pulled no punches about it. He told me the same thing. Except the one problem I sensed early on was that he was inclined to move in the direction of creating departments for the sciences, although he was resistant to it, but surely he had no such intention for the humanities and social sciences.
That's true.
So he was willing to give if when the pressure was applied, which of course the science people were putting pressure on him about.
He wanted to be called
professor of natural science.
That's right, he departmentalized when I came in the sciences. I came and then as a result of my coming, Leonard Eisenbud came.
Right.
So he and I were the first two chairmen of those major science departments.
He was the first chairman of physics?
He was the first chairman of physics. And
was he at Little also?
No, he was at the Bartle Foundation, but he and I had known each other since Oak Ridge days, immediately post-war.
I see.
He heard I was going to this unheard-of college on Long Island and called me up and find out what's going on, and one thing led to another, and he came at the same time.
Well, and then there's the other scripting, very important Bowen Chill Fleischer episode.
The Bowen Chill Fleischer episode
flushed out a lot of them.
The Bowen Chill Fleischer episode is the one that put the pressure on the development of engineering, because they made public accusations.
Yes.
They said that Leonard Olson was subverting his mandate because he had a mandate to offer to develop a program in engineering, and he was admitting students in engineering, but did not have a single program. Faculty member.
No faculty, no program.
That was in the New York Times.
That's right.
Can I get you something to drink?
Just a soda or a seltzer or plain water. Anything simple.
Same for me.
Well, all right. I've got a root beer here.
Could be water, too.
I've given him some soda, but I'll see if I've got any more soda.
I'm sorry, I already had some soda. But I need more, I've been eating peanuts.
Peanuts. You get a little thirsty after a while. Yeah, that was right. They made that a major...
That was what put
I'll
the bone
some of contention. Your soda.
Okay.
And
soda or water?
Well, I have soda, unless you want to insist on
and
giving
it to
Tom.
You know, you have to realize, part of that whole pattern of publicity, that did not help Olson very much, because that case developed enormous publicity. I mean, you remember people like Jacques Barz?
I forget about these three guys. What was their problem?
They were hired from Columbia University. I knew them all. They were hired in 57, the first
what
year.
What was their field?
Bowen was in history.
History and political science.
Chill was political science.
No, Marty was political
science. Marty and Chill was history.
Marty Chill, I think, was actually a student of Ralph Bowen.
Yeah, he was a student of Ralph Bowen's. And they were recruited from Columbia. Yeah. The senior person there was Ralph Bowen. And
Ralph was a full professor. He's brought in as a professor. The other two guys were
junior faculty
assistant manager. Professors. In fact, neither of them, I think, had completed a PhD yet at the time.
You're right. They were both working on it at
the
time.
Thank you.
But
was in the summer of 59, Leonard Olson decided to eradicate this Columbia cancer.
Right.
So he fired
them. They all were on 3-year terms. He fired them all simultaneously.
Bowen came in as a full professor on a 3-year term.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bowen in what department?
History.
Well, it wasn't a department, it was in the Division of Social Sciences, but he was a historian, French history, his background.
So they decided to blow it. Right?
They blew it. Well, they fought it, and they got a lot of publicity. And publicity again, the Times. In a sense, the campus started to become more visible. And I think that was one of the, ultimately, when Olson was, I think, very upset and disappointed that they went outside to get a president, namely in Lee. I think this certainly didn't do him any good.
See, Lee always complained to me towards the end that when he took the presidency, that they told him in Albany that the best thing to do was that Olson should leave. And that he made a pitch to have Olson stay on as dean or something like that.
He sure made a mistake.
That was a terrible mistake. That was a big mistake. He thought that he could placate Lee. He could placate Olson. Mm-hmm. That's right.
But this Bowen-Fleischer-Chill episode was played up in the press. They succeeded in getting a good deal of press attention to it as an ideological conflict.
Exactly.
And it was an ideological conflict.
That was exactly right, as a matter of fact.
Let's state the two sides again for my benefit.
The Columbias and the Chicagos.
That's right. That's exactly what it was.
Chicago evenings.
Olson, when he came to recruit, I remember in 57, he came to I was at Columbia at the time, and he came to recruit, as a matter of fact, he talked to Buckler. He came to him, and he talked to a number of other people. And I think I met him once at a lunch at Columbia, 1957. Yeah. And the people at the university proposed different names of people. He was seeking people essentially who would populate his concept of the Division of Social Sciences. Meantime, at the same time, he was hiring people for a Division of Humanities, and these he drew from Chicago. And he was working on a kind of peculiar theory, because I remember once talking to him, and he was talked about the sense of balance that he was trying to bring in, that if he had the best of general education that had been developed in the United States, in the 50s, for example, he would end up having Chicago and Columbia, and he would thereby get the purest and the best product as a result of that. But the whole approach to general education, Chicago was very different from that of Columbia. in Chicago, when you gave a course, that it was absolutely fully disciplined. Everyone had to teach the same thing, the same reading. Well, we had that club with the contemporary civics. However, there wasn't this kind of uniformity somehow of outlook. As a matter of fact, one prized great individual differences of points of view. And of course, you deal with issues of social science, it's a little more exciting than humanities in this regard. But I think Olson really felt that he would have the best of all possible worlds here. And he would have these people there serving in a division, no departments. Another thing that Ralph Bowen very much wanted, was getting more and more irritated, and that was, of course, bothering Olson. He couldn't stand this divisional structure and wanted, I mean, he felt he was a professor of history. He wanted to also be called professor of history, not professor of social science.
I had the same problem, you know. He wanted me to head up a division of engineering.
Engineering sciences.
I said, no way. Engineering's a college, you know. It's a professional college. But that's the way they wanted to keep the division structure.
He gave in on departments in this.
In the sciences.
In the sciences, yep. When Leonard Eisenberg and I came. But we still had a division.
I know.
We still had a division.
In departments within the division.
It was departments within a division. And it was departmentalized from the time I came.
Then there was another important thing, I think, ideologically. And I think Bonechel, Fleischer, yes, they were very much part of the general education. However, they all felt very strongly that there had to be developments in particular fields, in particular professional areas.
They were Columbia people.
Yes, and Columbia was never a divisionalized structure. Columbia, if anything, was super powered by departments, strong departments. And Chicago, on the other hand, the undergraduate college, was almost an entity unto itself and had very little connection with the departments through some of their structures.
Chicago College?
Yes. Yeah. And the
That's true. Yeah.
And the problem was, essentially, that also felt that we, you know, Oyster Bay would do well in adopting that basic Chicago outlook. But time was against him, traditions were against him, people were essentially moving towards departmental structures. If you're going to bring in good scholars, they didn't want to just wander around divisions, you see.
That situation in Chicago changed after Hutchins left.
That's right. That's right.
But that's true. There was and for a long time, there was under Hutchinson's, there was an essentially separate college faculty.
That's right.
That did not
have appointments in departments.
They didn't have appointments in regular academic departments.
And that was one of the differences of the ideology, too. And I think Olson was very anti-departmentalist. He really thought all evil came from departments.
Yeah.
And I remember having an argument with him once. I said, evil comes from people, not from departments. And he was saying, oh, when you put them in departments, it gets worse. And I said, well, if you put them in universities, it gets even worse. You know, so what? Doesn't prove anything. When did Cliff come?
57.
I was going to say, I think he's original.
He's an aboriginal.
He's a real.
He's the first.
That's
the first.
So he's in the very first.
You came in 60.
60. John came in September, and I came in January.
John came in September of 59?
Yeah.
Really?
I thought he came in about January.
No, I came in January. Hi, Cliff.
Cliff. It's like the same old gang.
We call it the gang of four.
Yeah. I remember Phil.
Yes, you remember the old days.
They've been reminiscing. And
well, you know, Francis and I just talking that he's antecedent to all of us.
He's aboriginal.
He's an aboriginal.
Yes. I understand.
But I didn't take it seriously.
Well, no. Who did? That was the trouble. That's why they have problems.
What could I get you to drink?
Oh,
I have beer, I have white wine, I have bourbon and scotch.
A beer, I have.
Beer?
Yes. Wow.
That's it. You could fill us in on the landscape there in that very first year, 57.
We ought to have a list of faculty. I think they're open. You were 14.
You had 14
including the first Cook.
Yeah, I know Cook came there.
Including Len Olson.
You had Harold Ziskind.
Harold Ziskind. And Dick.
Right.
Dick Mullen.
Dick Mull.
Frank Erd.
Barry Gordon.
Frank Erd.
Frank Erd. And a mathematician named Kalachowski.
Yes. Oh. I once asked him what was his name before he was a mathematician.
Right. I've been telling that story for years. That's true. Harold Miskin, and when did
Walter Watson?
No.
Came the year
came
after,
the
I think. I know Sternfeld came after. No, Sternfeld came the year I came.
Oh, okay.
Came in 58.
Sternfeld came in 58.
Yeah.
Well, and then the early year, I don't know whether the first year. Or
Merrill Roden, was he there?
Tom,
yes,
Tom Rogers.
Tom Rogers.
Tom Rogers and Merrill Roden.
Merrill Roden. And what about,
you mentioned Mull.
Yeah. Dick Mull.
What about who?
Also teaches English.
Ed Feast.
He came in 57?
He came in 57.
57.
I see.
Now, early on, I think the first year, there was somebody in Poly Sci.
Well, and Bo and Fleischer Chill, too, the three of them.
That's right.
Were they there?
Of course, they
yes.
came in 57.
They, their three-year terms were up.
Okay.
Yeah.
But how about the guy in Poly Sci?
Williams.
Williams.
Yes, Williams.
Jay
came
Williams.
Oh,
Jay
Williams came the
yeah.
first year.
Yeah. He was, are you sure?
Well, I'm not sure whether the first was.
Wait, now I'm not
I,
so
I
kind certain. Of
think he
I
was
think,
the second
I think he came the second year.
I was particularly impressed to learn that he had actually produced something. I was given to believe that he'd written a number of books. And it turns out, actually, he was on some sort of editing team.
From the Committee of Social Thought.
I wonder if
like
I
that.
Could
Chicago.
Bring us to consider this for just a few minutes. Skip item one. We've discussed Dave Trask and John Pratt just briefly. And do any of you know whether they got anything down in writing?
No, I don't think they got anything down.
Okay.
I'm almost certain they did. I mean, they went so far as to collect. You see, we asked them to do this in the early 70s to start.
When were they asked to do that?
When we did the self-study in the campus in 1972, we asked the history department if they would, the committee had suggested that we go to them and asked them to begin compiling appropriate materials so they could develop a writer history of Stony Brook. And they sent out notices at the time, so the archives were kept in the library to collect anything and everything related to that people might have had in their files going back to day one.
Nobody ever asked me. I got all those Spike Martin memos.
Jesus. So there's a lot of rich stuff because we were sure that they had gotten out that Trask and John Pratt took Trask assigned John Pratt the responsibility for coordinating this, and Pratt had I think one or two graduate students. I forget now.
We'll have to get to John.
Do some archives exist?
I was told then that they had a lot of material that was sitting over there in the library.
They have some.
That they had collected a lot of material, but I don't know how much or how good it is, frankly.
Well,
there's a lot of material. I have files, you know, that I'm sitting there, which I could give. I gave them a lot of material I had earlier anyway, but I have a lot of other material I found.
I think Folkers ought to get out a memorandum to the chairman or to individuals to come in with what they are willing to part with.
Who should?
Ebert Folkers is in charge of
the archives.
Collections. Which is the archives.
Yeah.
And he's a good professional.
Yeah. Well, he definitely should do that because I'm sure that the materials are just attenuating.
Exactly.
The way things are going.
Yeah.
Now, okay. From one sense, there is a story in here of a person in a small group who intended to create something, and from their point of view, were thwarted, and the effect it had on these people was, this is a small human tragedy that went on around a little over here. I happen to be on the side that believed that, that it was a group incapable of producing what they thought they remembered, and that it should not have been created. Nevertheless, it was a human tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
And had several different tragic aspects on both sides.
This group was consisted of
Chicago groups. Chicago, so that we were enumerating certain people and issues, and to Carl earlier.
Divisional organization.
Len Olson, I believe, really thought he was going to create a new Chicago.
I think Leonard Olson thought that he was going to succeed where Robert Hutchins had failed.
Exactly.
And despite Robert Hutchins' snooty attitude about public institutions, he was going to do it
in a public institution. Well, in the state, wasn't there a fellow by the name of Clarence Faust or something? See, Chicago...
He was at Chicago.
Ford, but you see, what I used to call the Chicago Mafia... I mean, they infiltrate everywhere, into foundations, into higher education, and so on.
Did.
And Faust, I think, got Olson to work for the for SUNY system. Faust was brought in from the Ford Foundation as a consultant in building this whole thing. And there was a very strong commitment on the part of all these people to do precisely this, to restructure in the public institutions what had occurred in Chicago, but to do it with some degree of much clearer success, and they could get to the public till was supportive for this venture. And I think it wasn't just an accidental thing that they happened to dream up this idea. They were real ideologically committed. These were ideologues. The trouble was, I think, to a large extent, is that you had a group of ideologues versus a group of others who didn't share a single common ideology of any sort, except they wanted to build a university with a great variety of disciplines and interests and so on.
I think that's true. I mean, when you said what were the opposing ideologies, I said it was the Chicagos versus the Columbias. That was true in the very narrow sense of what happened to Bowen, Fleischer, and Chill. I mean, but Bowen, Fleischer, and Schill also represented something much broader than that. And the real conflict was between an ideological orientation and a non-ideological, but pro-broad university development.
I viewed it at the time and strongly feel this way now. There was a slightly different aspect to it, and that was that the ideologues were second-rate people.
If not fifth.
All right, they certainly were not... Hutchins, I never remember the son or Hutchins and Abbott were brilliant and created things.
Oh,
among other things, they created that institution
form
out there. And every time you have such an arrangement, you attract disciples. And when the great people go away, then the disciples try to freeze what they remembered, and it becomes a cult.
But you're right, Cliff, and these people were not, however, which is interesting, they were not in the group of disciples.
These were definitely lesser Chicago.
These were all lesser lights. Look, Olson was a good case in point. Olson couldn't get his, finish his graduate work. They couldn't give him a PhD in philosophy. They got rid of him in the philosophy department.
Yeah.
Cummings had told me once at Columbia, who had been at Chicago and came to Columbia to teach, that... he was almost persona non grata in the philosophy department, yet he posed as a philosopher. And part of the problem is these people really had almost a non-disciplinary orientation. They kind of came out of that environment of the college, and unfortunately they were not the leading lights, any one of them.
And there was something even worse that happened, and that is that occasionally there was, I think, charlatanism. I think of a person named Bremer.
Bremer.
John Bremer. I think he was a fraud and a charlatan. And
he was in the news. Olson.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he was brought in the humanities division. I mean,
he taught everything.
And
he was a complete savant.
Astronomy, whatever you want.
No. He taught.
He taught physical science.
Ptolemaic. You remember he taught it.
Ptolemaic, right?
Ptolemaic astronomy.
Oh, that's tough stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And it was sort of a brilliant Well, actually, of course, I don't know what he did. That was part of the problem.
No, you don't know what he did. But he was a shady, he was really a shady character.
I agree, I agree.
I always thought there was something shady about Merrill Roden, too.
Oh, yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, no, you're absolutely right. These were hangers-on.
He was very close to Wilson.
I remember the Roden.
The closest. He was the closest.
Well, sorry, when I say second-rate, immediately I think to myself, I shouldn't say second-rate, but by this definition, they themselves did not create the scholarly works of any sort that we normally think of.
Nor were they associated with
the books, the articles, or any of the other scholarly things.
No, they had no, their CV contained no intellectual accomplishment.
They were... as ideologues, they felt very strongly that these things were not to be prized. I mean, they went so far.
It was a kind of anti-intellectualism.
Yeah, it was almost a kind of nihilistic attitude, I found.
What I don't understand from a distance is how, if they were starting an institution down here, they could have appointed Olson in the first place to do the job. Now, this was Carlson, was it? Because
it was Carlson, wasn't it?
I think so.
I think it was just like sending an administrative assistant down to
get that
place. I don't think he was giving him a big assignment. I think Carlson thought of it was going to be a little teacher's college, and it was like sending an administrative assistant. He never gave him much scope, really. I mean, he never had the title of acting president or chief executive officer.
Yeah, but didn't you think, now this I found interesting, is one of the problems, I think there was some degree of hubris in Olson, in the sense that I think he took on a mandate for himself, which was never necessarily handed to him.
I think that's right.
But given the bureaucracy, you know, till things got back, he, he got away with murder.
He had the power to hire.
Exactly.
And give him ranks. So he brought him in.
You know,
it was the procedure of the fait accompli. I mean, he always went for fait accompli.
You know, it's funny when he came to when he asked me to come out and we talked, and I remember a very negative reaction. So much so that I was ready to move. We were living in Glencoe when they first talked to me in about possibly coming out. And I had such little, at that time, interest in thinking I would even go that we moved to Greatland so I'd be close to Columbia. My commuting to New York, wanted to be on the island. And the first meeting with Olson, I said to him, why don't you adopt, he was saying, well, does the university have any idea? The way he went around, he always asked you a lot of questions. And said, well, how would you go about? I said, well, I've always felt it's very important to have, you know, to be part of a new enterprise in the university, whatever. And
what have we got? Digital tape?
Digital tape? The new digital tape?
Those cassettes are so tiny.
They go for 3 hours.
Do you know how to take care of this thing?
There's an engineer here. What are you talking about? He can take care of anything.
What's the speed of that?
He's thermal. You need electronics. That's
right.
Right. It's running.
He'll put it in there.